It's Monday, November 10th, 2014. That means it's time for the knee-jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm the Big Al of the equation, Al Beaton, co-managing editor of BlessYouBoys.com, SB Nation's Detroit Tigers blog. But I like to talk about other sports other than baseball. So every week I get together with my good friend Greg Eno of GregEno.com. He also contributes to numerous other websites, including Bless You Boys and the Detroit Athletic Club blogs. He can give you all the details, but let's get the introduction out there. Greg, how's things?
Things are well, Al Beaton. Thank you so much for the lovely intro. I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com. That's where you can read me every day of the week. Follow me on Twitter, at Greg Eno. Follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter, at the Knee Jerks. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/the Knee Jerks, and our blog is thenejerks.us, and that's you can find out what's going on with the program. We will be flying solo tonight, Al and I. No guests tonight, but as guests are being booked, we will certainly let you know via Twitter, Facebook, and our blog, so keep an eye out for that. Lots going on tonight as usual. Lions, MSU, we'll talk a little bit about both of those football teams, and maybe a little bit more about some other stuff that Al's got cooking. But before we get to any of that, it's time to play a game we like to call Whose Birthday Is It, Maestro?
Happy birthday to you.
Everybody pretty much knows how we play this game by now. I give Al a clue or two or three, an individual whose birthday it is today in the world of sports. And if Al can correctly guess that clue, or that person, I should say, within the first two clues, he will receive a year's supply of Bazooka bubblegum.
All right, Bazooka Joe. All
remember
right.
that? Yes. Yeah, remember that. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. This person, Al, he made his name in baseball, I would tell you that. He was born on this date in 1955, so he's 59 years old today. Was born in, this part's not really going to help you, but he was born in New Brighton, Pennsylvania. He made his big league debut in 1975 for the San Francisco Giants. And little did anybody know that at age 19, actually, mm-hmm. believe it or not, because he hadn't turned 20 yet. Little did anybody know that that would be the beginning of an 18-year career that would put him as a four-time All-Star, a two-time Silver Slugger, 340 home runs, and a career that spanned five teams, beginning with the San Francisco Giants and ending in 1992 with the Boston Red Sox. That would be your first clue.
Oh, wow. You gave a lot of information there, actually. More than normal for the first question. But, you know, I'm still kind of grasping it. You know, a couple names came to mind, but I now that I think about it, they're not correct. I'm going to have to let this one germinate a little bit more, but you know, so I have no clue at this point. Then again, you can say that about me a lot, so nothing new there.
Well, you've got one more clue to get the Bazooka Joe bubblegum, so.
All right, well, let's move on from there, and let's, talk a little bit of sports. We're going to have a little shorter episode this week because, one, it was a quieter week in Detroit sports as, you know, we talked a lot about the Pistons and the Red Wings over the past couple of weeks, and they're just kind of getting underway in the early parts of the regular season. The Tigers didn't do much of anything other than the announcement that Victor Martinez won the Silver Slugger as a DH. You know, who didn't see that coming? So, we can add. Well, yeah, maybe we touch on that at the end, that Alan Trammell's rejoining the organization. Well, maybe we'll touch on that at the end of the show, but it's going to be pretty much a football-centric show. Specifically with the Detroit Lions with another big victory this weekend and Michigan State, failing to hold up the mantle of the Big Ten, who now looks very much in trouble of getting a team in the college football playoff. But let's move on first and talk Lions because I think that'll dominate our discussion tonight. Once again, Greg, this team had me on the edge of my seat, stomach churning, sweat, little beads of sweat rolling down the forehead, and that wasn't because of the nachos I was eating. Once again, this team came back to win on the final drive of the game. In this case, against the a very good, I think underrated Miami Dolphins team with a defense damn near as good, if not better, than the Lions. The Dolphins were up 16-13. under a minute to go. 29 seconds left in the game. Matthew Stafford had the Lions at the 11, and he threw a touchdown pass on third down. It was a tough throw, risky throw. Kind of sidearmed it, slung it in there into a small area. Theo Reddick made the catch, game-winning touchdown pass, and they beat the Dolphins 20-16. The Lions have won four games in a row now, Greg. They lead the NFC North, but that's the third game in a row where they've had to come from behind to win in realistically scrambling comeback fashion. So calling them cardiac cats kind of fits at this point. It's not how you want to go all season, but it also does go to show that these Lions, you really can't count them out of any game. Even though this one went a little differently, that they get out to a fast start, a 10-0 lead, and it was the Dolphins who took good deal of control during long stretches of the game. So once again, though, the Lions, much like last year, have themselves in excellent shape to make the playoffs, but I have a feeling this year we're not going to see a collapse at the end, a collapse down the home stretch.
This was a big one to get out because they've got the next 2 weeks at Arizona, at New England. Those are two very difficult road games. Had they lost Sunday to go 6-3, that 6-3 could have really turned into 6-5 real fast.
Yes.
And it would have been an indictment on them because those are two very good football teams to play on the road, Arizona and New England. So this was important for that reason, you know, just for that reason alone. And, you know, it was also important because it was a home game, obviously. It was mm-hmm. the first game back after the bye and, you know, a lot of other things that went along with it. But, you know, they seem to be a team, Al, that starts off real good and ends real good, and they're not really very good in the middle. You know, they tend to let the thing get away from them a little bit in the second and third quarters, and then they finish strong. They had another great start Sunday. Really got the crowd into it.
Mm-hmm.
Defensively, and they mainly did it defensively, just swarming Ryan Tannehill and just manhandling the Dolphins' offensive line in the first quarter.
Yeah, it looked like it was going to be a blowout, especially the way the Lions' defense was playing.
And that's the thing, Al, is that's not the first time
right.
where they've started out fast and you've thought this looks like it's going to be a blowout. And the biggest example of that, the worst example, was the Buffalo game. That was a game that you really thought they were going to blow the Bills out of the building. And they left a bunch of points on the field. The kickers mm-hmm. couldn't make a field goal, and they just let the Bills hang around. And that one ended up burying them at the end.
Right.
They've escaped New Orleans. They escaped Atlanta. Now they've escaped Miami. It's not the way that you want to, you know, you lay it out on the blackboard, but on the other hand, Al, mm-hmm. these are, you know, if you look at the way they won these games and you look at the quotes during the week after each of these victories, you can really see that these guys are they're forming camaraderie. They're rallying around Jim Caldwell. I get the feeling they really like playing for Jim Caldwell. I get the feeling he's like a father figure. You know, there were some quotes that came out during the course of the week. Of course, there was 2 weeks between games, so there was a lot of time for quotes to come out. But there were some quotes that kind of took some shots at Jim Schwartz indirectly by both former players and current players. More in praise of Jim Caldwell, but kind of also at the same time, not mentioning Jim Schwartz by name, but certainly mentioning Jim Schwartz by his era here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that you don't like to have to sweat these things out. I know the fans don't, but just like I think the fans feel like that they have the feeling that the Lions, the more that this happens, they get more of the feeling that they can indeed do it. I think the players, more importantly, have the feeling that they can do it. I mean, Stafford, say what you will, and we've all had our criticisms about his accuracy and his footwork and his mechanics and what have you. But you know, this quarterbacking late in the game is you can't. You got to give the guys due. I don't know what it is, but when it comes down to when the game's on the line, you know, like it was on Sunday, you know, mm-hmm. 11 play drive. They looked really bad on the drive just before that 3-and-out, and then but then the defense got a 3-and-out themselves, and then Stafford hit his first 5 passes on the game winning drive,
mm-hmm.
11 play drive. Just no panic. You know, that's the other thing. There's there doesn't seem to be any panic. Calvin Johnson said it after the game. He said, you know, we've got a core of guys that have been here for the last 4 years or so, and we've all been through these situations so many times, and we've all been there when we've rallied to win games. And he's right. I mean, you know, the team success, overall team success isn't really there yet. They've only had one playoff appearance in the last 5 years. Well, not since 5 years, but, you know, since Johnson and Stafford have been there. But he's right. They, in the time that they've been together, there have been a lot of fourth quarter, 13 to be exact, fourth quarter game-winning drives that Matthew Stafford has led. And, you know, that's, I'm not sure where that ranks in the NFL since 2009, but it's got to be up there, you know, among the tops. So, you know, that's, there's something to be said about being able to do that. You don't want to do that. But to be able to do it and to kind of expect that you're going to do it and to be genuinely surprised if you don't, I mean, that's also a mark of a good team. You know, and they've done it on the road, too. They've done it on the road and at home. This is just something that happens with Ford Field. So we'll see how that plays out and, you know, later on what kind of confidence that gives them. But you're right. I agree with you. I don't see now, they may not, you know, set the world on fire, but I don't see a collapse coming either. I just don't have that feeling.
Right.
I just don't. I mean, although I looked at the schedule, I thought if they did lose on Sunday, they could go to 6-5 real fast, but I don't look at that as a collapse. I mean, a collapse is losing 7 out of 8 or 6 in a row or something. Mm-hmm. I don't see that happening with this unit. They just seem to be getting a lot of confidence. Rob Sims said it before the game late last week. He said, we're not going to make that mistake again by kind of saying, well, we, you know, kind of taking the second half of the season lightly. You know, with Jay Cutler was out, Aaron Rodgers was out, and it looked like the path was just completely clear for the Lions to kind of waltz to the NFC North title. And obviously they didn't. And Rob Sims said, we're not going to let that happen again. And I believe him. I mean, the way they play, you know, they don't always look pretty, and they don't always look like they're going to make it happen. But there's something about Stafford, you know, that even the, you know, I know his critics will say that they will poo-poo it, but I don't know how you poo-poo 13, you know, fourth quarter comebacks. You know, I guess what you really have to you got to give the critics their point of, well, you know, has he done it in the playoffs? Has he done it against really, really good teams? You know, okay, you can nitpick it. You can nitpick it and cherry pick some reasons why you're not impressed. Mm-hmm. But all I know is the Lions are 7-2, and they haven't been 7-2 in a very long time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a good point about Stafford in that he has 31 wins overall as a starting quarterback, and almost a little less than half, as you said, 13 of them have been fourth quarter comebacks, and actually he's led 15 game-winning drives. So that says a lot about Stafford when it comes down to, as you know, when the game's on the line. This kid seems to have ice in his veins, as he said, and it kind of brings the Bobby Lane comparisons back, just because obviously they went to the same high school, but Bobby Lane was also known for as a guy who didn't always have the best numbers during, you know, and didn't play well at times during games, but when the game was on the line, Bob, you could not stop Bobby Lane. In a lot of ways, Stafford's, you know, you can't compare him because obviously Lane is a Hall of Famer who won championships, but still the comparisons are there just because Stafford just seems to, he looks like he could be, as we've seen in all of these like games that they've won recently in this 4-game winning streak, Stafford has been ineffective for long stretches. But when the time came, as they say, when it was winning time, Stafford stepped up to mix metaphors, Stafford stepped up to the plate and hit it out of the park.
Yeah, well, you're right. And the thing about Lane, too, Al, is that he almost would purposely bait other teams. He would almost like sandbag. He'd almost purposely not play well in the first half, or at the very least, he didn't care if he or the team.
Or he was recovering from his hangover still. One of the two. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And you know, he was known to even have a nip at halftime as well. But you know, the thing about that is that he would, Lane, on top of Bobby Lane now, he would just kind of lull the other team to sleep, and as long as he kept the game close, then all of a sudden he turned on that that ability, like you said at the end. They always said that Bobby Lane never lost a game; he just ran out of time, you know.
Yes.
But he did have that kind of, Stafford does have that flair for the dramatic, and you know, he said it after Sunday's game. He said it's fun. Mm-hmm. It's fun to have the football in that situation, and that's what you want to hear. You want to hear your quarterback say that kind of stuff. It's not, you know, it's one thing to go out there and do it, but to actually want to be in that moment, to really thrive in that moment, you know. He's starting to earn a little bit of a reputation now, I noticed, among the announcers and the other out-of-town people, that he's got this ability to, it's never over until, it's never, you can't go to sleep on him. And, you know, I want to talk about real briefly about Mike Schottie, a friend of the Knee Jerks we've had on numerous times. And I bring Mike up because if you remember, Al, when we first started this, Matt Stafford's career kind of runs concurrent to the show, because
we started
the show in 2009, and that's when Stafford started. And if you recall, Mike Schottie, on more than one occasion, voiced concerns. This is before Matt Stafford even played an NFL game. Voiced concerns about Stafford's mechanics. I'll never forget that. He was a little bit critical. You know, he was not really critical of the pick itself, because, you know, who else are you going to pick? I remember back then, some people wanted that linebacker, Aaron Curry.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Yeah, it just tells how nuts fans can be. But, yeah, exactly. And where is he now? I have no idea.
And Schottie was telling us, you know, I like Stafford. He's a good pick, but a little bit concerned about his mechanics. And Mike, you know, has coached a little bit of football in his career and was telling us about it. Neither of us, of course, had really seen Matt Stafford play a whole lot, so we really couldn't, certainly not as much as Mike had seen him play. So we weren't really sure, you know, if Mike's concerns were Chicken Little, or if they were, legitimate. And it's turned out that ever since Matt Stafford's been in the league, the knock on him has been his mechanics, just like Mike Schottie has said. And, so it's interesting how that still follows Stafford despite all these comebacks. And you could also be a cynic and say that some of these comebacks were needed because Matt Stafford screwed up earlier in the game, you know, by throwing interceptions and not taking care of the football. So the Lions were forced to come back at the end. But regardless of the reason, he's been able to do it, and I know that there's still critics out there, and I'm still a critic, frankly. I still want to see him do it, you know, really in crunch time. You know, but I tell you what, it can't hurt. It can't hurt the psyche. If the Lions ever get into the playoffs and they get into a situation where they have to drive down the field to win a playoff game, I feel a lot better knowing that they've done it a lot in the regular season.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I just looked it up. Aaron Curry is out of football. He is retired.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, he's played in 13 games with the Oakland Raiders in 2011-2012, and that was the end of his career.
So wow, that's
really you're right. And it was, remember the protest that fans, we want a defense, we want a linebacker.
Yes.
And Curry was, at that time, was considered the top player defensively in the draft, and the Lions said, no, we need a quarterback. And
thinking back to that, I was never a proponent of the Aaron Curry thing at all. I mean the Lions were coming
neither
off
one of us. We always thought, yeah, you got to go quarterback if you're going to take linebackers that high. You just don't.
No, you don't. I mean, you're 0-16. Looking back on that Aaron Curry thing, I don't even know why that even got any legs. And I'm not saying that because Matt Stafford has turned out to be a pretty decent quarterback. I'm just saying that I don't know how you can look at an 0-16 team and say that you're going to build around a linebacker. I mean, that's essential. When you're taking the number one draft pick in the entire draft, that's a player you build your franchise around. And it's not going to be a linebacker. I'm sorry. And I know the fans wanted, like you said, they wanted defense back then. But my goodness, when you're 0-16, you need everything. And so you may as well go for the thing that is the most important position on the football field. And with all due respect to middle linebackers or outside linebackers, it's the quarterback, period. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is. So it's amazing to me. And then I'm not even saying that because Aaron Curry's out of football now.
Right.
Even if Aaron Curry turned into an all-pro linebacker, I would still say the same thing. You don't build build for, especially from the rubble of 0-16, you don't build with a linebacker.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know who the Lions did draft did pick in that draft as a linebacker? DeAndre Levy in the third round, and he's going to make the Pro Bowl this year.
He damn well better.
Which goes to show you just what fans do and don't know. We don't know nearly the extent that the the guys in the front office do. We could do a whole podcast and all that kind of stuff, but it's just funny to look back at the hate for Stafford. And is he the best quarterback in the NFL? No. Is the talent there? Yes. Is he still a lot of potential there to even be in better? Yes. But right now, he's still the best quarterback we've seen in our lifetimes anyway for the Detroit Lions, pure and simple. All right. One thing I found interesting about this game, and this more so in this game I've seen in the past with the Lions, is that it looks like the defense is changing how the Lions approach the game plans or what they can do on the field. Specifically in this game against the Dolphins, the Lions tried two fake punts. One was successful, and they also went for it on 4th and 6. I know, yes. That seems kind of extreme most of the time, but it was also successful. But most of these all happened, I think, they were on the Dolphins' side of the 50. And I just got the impression that the Lions realizing they have a dominant defense, it can change how you approach down and distance. When you see a defense flying around, making plays and hitting everything that moves, you're pretty confident that even if you do turn the ball over, say at the opposition 40 or 45, you're confident you're still going to be able to stop them. And we saw that with the play call we saw today.
You know, I saw that in the show notes, and I hadn't thought of that, but that's an excellent point you make, and you're right on the money. I really hadn't thought of that, but you're absolutely right. If you have a defense that you have confidence in, mm-hmm. and you cite the two fake punts and the 4th and 6, and I would argue that the 4th and 6 is probably a better example of that.
Yeah.
The fake punt, you know, that was, you know, that's something you did that if you execute it properly, is not as huge of a risk as some people may think. Now, the one of the to Jed Collins, mm-hmm. was perfectly executed. The pass, right. over there to Abdul Qudus was on the wrong side of him. He had to reach out for it. And
actually, the Dolphins kind of suckered him into it because they ran a play.
The Dolphins sniffed it out. The Dolphins almost sniffed that one out.
Right.
But the 4th and 6 is the one I think that is the best example of that, because, you know, everybody can try a fake punt around midfield on occasion. That's all fine and dandy. But when you're going for it on 4th and 6, that's where you either have A, a lot of confidence in your offense, obviously, but B, mm-hmm. you have, like you said, you've got almost like a safety net that says, you know what, mm-hmm. even if we don't convert this, I feel really good about our defense being able to get a stop here, so I'm going to go for it. Now, you can also say, well, is that an indictment of the field goal kicking? Well, maybe a little bit. Matt Prater had another interesting day, you know, in a blocked field goal, and that maybe he didn't get a lot of elevation on it. And then, of course, he made a 50-yard, really drilled it.
But yeah, but that 4th and 6 was not a chip shot. It would have been 50-plus, so I could understand why they went for it. And it makes sense. I think coaches should do that more often. They really should.
You know, and that's what I like about Jim Caldwell. Jim Caldwell is, as the season is moving along here, as he's becoming to know his personnel better, know his players better, and get mm-hmm. a feel for his team, and, of course, the fact that they've had some success, so that doesn't hurt, he's starting to exhibit some out-of-the-box thinking, some daring. You know, he's starting to separate himself a little bit, Al, from the commonality of most NFL head coaches, which is mm-hmm. to play very safe, be very conservative. And I'm starting to see signs that he's not like that. I didn't really pay attention to how he coached when he was in Indianapolis, because I just didn't pay attention to the Colts back then.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know if this tendency was there in Indianapolis or not, but all I can go by is what I see in Detroit. And I'm seeing a guy that, you know, he rolls the dice, and I like that. I mean, I wish there was, like you said, I wish there was more of that in the NFL. You know, there's so many, and we talked about this with baseball with managers, how they go by the book all the time. And, you know, it's nice to see a guy, you know, have a feel for his players, have a feel for what they can do, and have confidence. And I tell you what, the players like that. So mm-hmm. You can't tell me that those guys, that offense you can't tell me that they did not enjoy being put back out there in 4th and 6 with, you know, the challenge of the coach is giving them an opportunity to make a big play. And it turns out that it was a big play by Calvin Johnson, an incredible hand-eye coordination catch.
Yep.
Where he bobbled it and juggled it and batted up in the air and, you know, kept his eye on it. It was an amazing play. And that is, that goes along with, you know, Jim Caldwell is striking me as a very savvy guy. I almost like, you know, sly like a fox. He knows that if he does some things now, in November, that they can come back and be beneficial to his team in December and January. And I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's statisticians have done the work, and they say coaches should do things like that more often, specifically when you're in the other team's territory and you're around the 40-yard line, when a punt is only going to get you 20 some yards of field position.
Sure.
So it makes sense to go for it more often. But as you said, coaches are so damn conservative and they're so at times risk averse that, and that if that had failed, you know that the media would have jumped all over that call, even though I think the fans love, and don't forget the fans love that kind of stuff too. I thought it was great. I want to see more of that. I want to see teams go for it just because, statistically, it makes sense.
You know what, Al? It puts pressure. If you, and here's something else that did, which didn't get a lot of play.
Mm-hmm.
The announcers didn't really pick up on it. But that decision to go for it on fourth and six. First of all, it puts pressure on the defense because now they've got to make one more stop. Defenses are so used to walking off the field after third down.
Yeah, and it forced the Dolphins to take a timeout as well.
That's what I was going to say right there. Nobody talked about that. That forced the Dolphins. I'm not sure if that's was one of Caldwell's intentions, but that is a byproduct of a decision like that. Now, the defense is used to walking off the field. In fact, they may have walked off the field, for all I know, before they were.
They sure looked it, because I think that was one of the reasons that led to the timeout, because they were completely unprepared for it. That is so out of the box in the NFL.
Right. Well, I knew that they were probably going to call a timeout because they just looked like they weren't ready as they were going in formation. I said, I bet you they're going to call a timeout, and they did. So now those timeouts become precious at the end end of a close game, and that did, the announcers didn't really pick up on that. I'm glad you did, because that was something that I saw right away. I said, they just burned a timeout. They forced the Dolphins to burn a timeout, and the Lions still converted.
Yeah.
So, again, the defenses are just used to, and defensive coordinators are used to, and head coaches, frankly, more so than the coordinators, are used to having their defenses walk off the field in that situation. And the Lions said, no, we're going for it, guys. And that puts all of a sudden our defense has to go out there and make another stop. And that's another thing that people don't really think about when gauging whether to go for it or not, is what you're doing is you're forcing the defense to make another stop.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, especially when you think you've done your job and you're starting to walk off the field, and they say, oh, whoa, you've got to come back. Now you've got to go back out there again and do it again. And 6 yards is that's not a long way. I mean, that's very convertible, especially when you've got, you know, Johnson and Kate, so that's why I love the decision. Like you said, from a down and distance standpoint, from a field position standpoint, you know, it did make sense. And I'm not saying Jim Caldwell is the only coach out of the 32 in the NFL that would have done that, but there are a lot of coaches out of the 32 who would not have. Mm-hmm. Now, for a lot of reasons, either they didn't feel comfortable with their offense, or they, you know, for whatever reason, would not have done that. But I like the fact the Lions seem to have a guy that is seems to do things, Al, with not just to do them, but has does them for a purpose, does them for a reason. He's got something up his sleeve. He's always thinking ahead, and that's what I like about him. I get the feeling that he's not coaching just for today, but he's coaching for 6 weeks from now. You know, I just get that I just get that feeling about him, and I think that's what the players like about Jim Caldwell, is that he's a very smart man, and I think that's not to say Jim Schwartz is a dummy, but I mean, I just think that, you know, that he seems to exude something that a je ne sais quoi that the previous administration just didn't.
Yeah, well, I would put it this way. It's like, it feels like Jim Schwartz was reactionary and Caldwell is
proactive.
Or as you put it, calculating.
Right.
And it's a huge difference. And as you said, when it comes to thinking ahead, now this is something that other teams have to kind of game plan for. Thinking, hey, the Lions are kind of unpredictable.
Right.
And they're down in distance now. I mean, they went 4th and 4th and 6. They've tried some fake punts. And a lot, and as I said, they're confident that their defense is going to be able to back them up if it falls through. So right. That is just, as you said, that's thinking ahead. That's like putting, now that's in the brains of the upcoming defensive coordinators of the teams they got to play right now. And it just makes so much sense now when the more you think about it that, though, you know, even if they hadn't paid off, it's something that could pay off, as you said, 6 weeks from now.
You know, I can understand, you know, people are, the armchair quarterback, you know, that's fine. Monday morning quarterback, that's fine. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? If the Lions had not converted on that 4th and 6, I really hope there would have been an uproar. Oh, what did they do to that? I mean, you know, come on now. I mean, let's have a little bit of risk taking. Let's put a little. What you're doing it's not so much a risk as you're putting pressure. To me, I don't look at it as a risk as much as I look at it as putting pressure on the defense.
Yeah, I want to tell you this way. I wasn't that fearful of the Dolphins' offense, and I felt that good about the Lions' defense that when you average the odds out, I liked it working out either way.
Yeah,
it didn't bother me at all, and I would hope you're right. I hope most fans feel that way.
Exactly, because you know what, four down territory just doesn't have to just be late in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
You know, this was in the third quarter. You know, and let's just kind of keep things in perspective. I think it was a good move, but let's not go crazy. You know, it wasn't the third quarter, so I think, you know, it's not the end of the world if you don't make it.
Right.
And it wasn't like the Dolphins were. You know, it wasn't like the Lions couldn't stop them, a la Michigan State, Ohio State on Saturday. Right. I mean, the Lions, you know, have a defense now that, you know, you can. I just think that everybody is moving in the same direction. The defense, I think, enjoys that kind of stuff. They want to get the ball back to the offense. The offense knows that, well, if we don't convert, we've got a stout defense. They can hold the fourth down. We can get the football back again. So, hey, that was it won't get a lot of play because it happened in the third quarter. But, you know, that was when you're forcing a team to burn a timeout, anytime in the second half, that's a good thing because those timeouts, when you don't have them at the end of the game, that's huge.
And that's always been one of my pet peeves of coaches, Greg, is coaches when you're inside the opposition 40 or you're around the 40-yard line and you punt. It feels like 9 times out of 10, the punt ends up becoming a touchback and you gain all of 15 yards of field position or something.
Sure.
That's the kind of thing that drives me nuts. And I, you know, you don't have to do it all the time. You know, as you said, you gotta pick your spots for it, but it just makes statistical sense when it's 4th and short and you're in opposition territory.
Right.
You go for it. It just makes too much sense. And as we said, more often than not, teams aren't ready for it. At the very least, you make them burn a timeout, then maybe decide to punt or something. But at least you got to put it out there more often, and more teams don't. That bugs me. All right. We also have to talk about the return of Calvin Johnson. He's essentially missed 4 games. He missed 3 full games, and then he was hurt, 4 games ago, and essentially missed almost all that one. So he did return from his ankle injury. Big game, 7 catches, 113 yards, and I believe it was a 49-yard touchdown pass, that one play drive of the Lions. But what was more interesting is that it didn't affect Golden Tate at all. Golden Tate had more catches, 11 catches, and 109 yards receiving. So that's exactly what the Lions drew up when they signed Golden Tate. That's what they want to see.
That's exactly what they wanted to see. I mean, Golden Tate, well, these two guys – you know, they haven't been on the field a whole lot yet, but when they start getting going, obviously Calvin's your deep threat. Calvin's your guy, on those cross patterns across the middle. He's the guy, that makes the big play. But Golden Tate is a perfect complement. He's the guy that you throw to underneath and let him make things happen. You know, he's always been, even when he was in Seattle.
Yards after
the yak. Oh, the yak is so important. The Lions are, I believe they said on the broadcast, 4th in the NFL in yak, behind just 3 other teams. And that's stout. I mean, when you have the ability to just turn an 8-yard pass into a 20-yard pass, and that's what Golden Tate gives you. Matthew Stafford is starting to learn that now, and so is Joe Lombardi, is that when you, all you need to do is get take the ball. He's very good in traffic, by the way. He's one of the better receivers that you'll see in the NFL who can run in traffic. There's not a lot of guys that can catch passes, especially his, he's not a big guy, you know, especially his size. They can catch passes underneath 6-7 yards away from the line of scrimmage with everybody around him and still somehow get 5 or 10 yards more yak, which is always, you know, usually moves the chains or at the very least puts you in, it turns a long down in distance into a manageable down in distance. You know, he's just so important. 11 catches, 109. That's perfect. That's what you're looking for. That's 10 yards a catch. You know, he doesn't have to make, you know, when Calvin Johnson was out, Tate's numbers per yards per catch obviously were greater because he became the number one option. But now with Johnson back, Tate now moves back to that other role, which is that secondary role where he doesn't have to catch the ball 20 yards downfield. He can catch it 10 yards downfield and try to make things happen. And it doesn't always work, but he's got such sure hands. That's the other thing about this guy. He catches the ball in traffic. He can run it in traffic. He makes people miss. He makes DBs, defensive backs miss. He's very elusive. He's slippery, and you can't fall asleep on him because he's, you know, just kind of hangs out there, and every once in a while he can find himself wide open. There was a nice 29-yard pass that Stafford found him wide open. It was the one where George Bell thought the pass was meant for him, and he tried to catch it and actually tipped it a little bit, but still, you know, Tate caught it. I mean, I just feel so good when they throw the ball to Golden Tate that he's not going to drop the ball, number one. Mm-hmm. And then he's going to make something happen after he catches it. I love the way he plays. He reminds me of a younger Steve Smith. He's not as crotchety as Steve Smith is, but he's got that kind of mentality that he wants the football. He's got the same body build as Steve Smith. He's a tough, pugnacious little receiver. And I love the way he plays football, and he's a perfect complement. You know, I'm usually not a big fan of free agent signings in the NFL because more often than not, I just don't think that they really, really help all that much. And I just don't really think that there's been a lot of teams that have won Super Bowls that have been the beneficiaries of big free agent splashes, but Tate is an exception to that rule because he is by far the best free agent signing of last offseason. I can't think of another free agent that has done more for his team this year than Golden Tate has for the Lions.
Yeah, he's going to have a 1,000-yard year. He may do it next week. I believe he's over 900 now. You're right. That's the big, most impactful free agent in the NFL this year by far. And even more so considering how he picked up the slack when Calvin Johnson got hurt. But the Lions have been searching for, ever since Megatron broke out and became, you know, the number one guy and one of the best players in football. They've been looking for that number two guy. They thought it'd be Nate Burleson. They thought it'd be Ryan Broyles. Right. Well, they finally found him in Golden Tate.
Right.
All right, you alluded to the schedule earlier. We got to talk a little bit about that because it's the next 3 weeks are going to be, I won't say it's going to, the season hinges on it because the Lions have given themselves a bit of a cushion now, being 5 games over .500. But this is one of the tougher stretches any team in football is going to have. They play on the road the next 2 weeks. They play next week against Arizona, who did win today. So they're 8-1, best record in football. And they also play New England the next week on the road, who are 7-2. Now it's tied with the Lions. I believe that's the second best record in football. So, and then the next week, hard to believe, that's Thanksgiving week, which is a short week. At least it's at home, but it's against the Bears. It's always a big deal.
Sure.
But that's a lot of football in 3 weeks. And a lot of, I guess you could call it high leverage football, important football, impactful football that we're not used to seeing from the Lions at this time of year. But, you know, right now, Arizona and New England, if they can get a split, I'd be walking on cloud nine because I really do think they can handle the Bears fairly easily on Thanksgiving Day.
You know, I agree with you. As we record this program, the Bears are playing the Packers in Green Bay. How the Bears play in Green Bay to me is going to show a lot about their character. There's beginning to be some fractioning. There's some scuttlebutt going on in Chicago right now that's not very good. Brandon Marshall et al. And so I worry about Chicago. When I say worry about them, I mean I don't know if they're either going to go sideways and completely go down the drain, or they're going to get it together and try to get themselves back into the mix. Now, how they play in Green Bay on Sunday night as we record this program will I think, go a long way toward answering that question of whether or not they're going to go in the tank or if they're going to pick themselves up. So I don't know what team's going to show up on Thanksgiving. By that point, the Bears may be fractured and maybe, you know, cashing it in, or they may still, you know, be showing up every Sunday. We'll see. Now, as far as Arizona and New England, I'm with you there. I mean, I don't think there's any Lions fan on the planet that would not take a split of those two games. You know, Arizona doesn't lose at home. They're just tremendous at home. New England is New England. I mean, look, you know, they're just. You know,
but there is one advantage now the Lions do have, is that Carson Palmer tore his ACL tonight. As we're recording this on Sunday. Yes, he tore his ACL. He looks like he's out for the year. And you know who the Cardinals' quarterback is now?
Drew Henson. Stanton?
Drew Stanton. Yeah, that's right. Stanton. Drew Stanton. Yes. Drew Henson, Drew Stanton. Exactly. It's Stanton.
Didn't Palmer just sign a 3-year extension?
Yep,
like the other
week.
Day?
He signed a huge extension this week. And he tore his ACL in the fourth quarter on Sunday.
Oh, no. Yeah, you know, I hate to see that. Reason I hate to see it is not that, you know, whether the Lions play them or not next week, I just kind of hate to see stars. I mean, frankly, one of the reasons I hate to see this is because, you know, they're but for the grace of God go I. I mean, you know, what if that happens to the Lions? I mean,
yes.
I just hate to see guys go down like that.
Oh, yeah, so I got that sinking feeling in my stomach when I saw Stafford take a huge hit in the win against Dolphins, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, their backup is Dan Orlovsky.
Well, isn't it funny how we were so concerned about Stafford's durability after his first two seasons, and I think it was Phil Simms that said, you know, just kind of remember that I went through this. You know, I got hurt a lot early in my career, and then I became very durable. And Stafford has not missed a start in I don't know how many years now.
Been a couple years now. And he's played through some injuries, but, you're right. Those first 2 years I just write off as fluke stuff that'll probably never happen again.
Isn't it funny, Al, how the greatest quarterbacks in NFL history have all been free from injury? I mean, it's amazing. I know that Montana had a little bit of an injury issue, and that's what allowed Steve Young to take over there. But you look at all the great quarterbacks in history of the NFL, and none of them really have been injury riddled. I mean, you've got some cautionary tales of guys who could have been good, like Neil Lomax and guys like that who couldn't stay healthy. But for the most part, you know, and Toller has been through this before too, by the way. I mean, he's been through this injury thing before with the Bengals. But you think back to all the great players, period, not just quarterbacks. They've all been able to stay healthy. I mean, you know, Barry Sanders, you know, only had one little knee injury in 93, but for the most part, he was healthy. But speaking of quarterbacks specifically, you know, Tom Brady never gets hurt. Aaron Rodgers rarely gets hurt, although he was top last year. But for the most part, these guys, top grade, elite quarterbacks seem to stay healthy for some. Yep. I don't know. You know, that's a byproduct of the fact you don't get sacked a lot. I don't know, but you know that you can't say that with the Lions this year because Stafford has been getting sacked. But they, you know, so it's good. It's encouraging to see that Stafford, for as much and he does get hit a lot, has been able to stay upright and stay. You know, because you're right. You nothing against Dan Orlovsky, but that's a big drop off. You know, before it was Sean Hill, which. Sean Hill was here. He played pretty well, but now Orlovsky is a big question mark. And it's a backup quarterback. Al, is a funny thing because you don't know how much money to put into that position. You know, you want to have a guy. Everybody would love. I mean, every coach in the country would like to have a backup quarterback that is not much of a drop off from the starter. But let's face it, backup quarterbacks. And I've said this before. Are backups for a reason. I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, not, if they were starting quarterbacks, they'd be starting somewhere. They're just not. But by the same token, they are still all NFL quarterbacks. They are all capable. But that would seem to be a big drop off. Now, Stanton, who seems to be actually was playing pretty well.
He did throw a touchdown pass in the win.
He seems to have kind of found new life after he left the Lions. So, you know, we'll see what goes on there. But, still, I mean, no Palmer or no Palmer, they're still a tough team.
No, they're still a tough team, but they got a little bit easier.
A little bit easier, but they play very well in that building. They're very good in that stadium. And the Lions, as you know, have had a lot of trouble winning in Arizona. In fact, I don't think they've done it since 1993. Yeah. So there's going to be some issues there. And of course, New England, say no more. I mean, they're New England. They'll always be New England.
Oh my God! When you said that the Lions hadn't won there in so long, you know, the game that flashed into my mind: Bobby Ross going for two.
Yeah. That was
one
of them.
Oh, my God.
That was one of them.
Oh, that was one of those games where I was like, what in the hell are you thinking?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God. Let's not look back in the past. We'll just get angrier and angrier if we talk about games like that. But I also find it interesting when you brought up backups are backup for a reason. Well, that's exactly what I heard on NBC tonight. Before we started the podcast, I had the NBC pregame on, and Tony Dungy's going on, because him being a former coach, he's going to say stuff like this: oh, the Cardinals will be fine under him, it'll be okay. And the other analyst goes, backups are backups for a reason. He's not Carson Palmer, so.
Right.
That's what drives me. I could go on about coaches on TV, but that's another whole argument altogether. All right, let's move on to one more NFL topic where we talk a little bit about college football. And that was the Adrian Peterson stuff is coming to a head, Greg. This past week, the NFLPA has requested Peterson, who was suspended for the child abuse charges, where he hit his kid with a switch to the point where the kid had open gashes and blood. He avoided jail time by reaching a plea deal on the child abuse case on Tuesday. So the NFLPA is requesting that Peterson should be immediately reinstated. Peterson pleaded no contest to reckless assault, which is a Class A misdemeanor, and his sentence is a combination of probation, fines, and community service. Now that the legal process has run its course, and you could argue either he did or didn't get what he deserved, but the legal process is done, and this is where things are going to get kind of sketchy, Greg, is now the NFLPA is like, yeah, you're going to reinstate him, right? Because, well, the legal process has run its course. He's going to do what it needs to be done. So let's put him back on the field. And the NFL has really kind of drug its heels on this. I think they've gotten burned so much because of the Ray Rice deal and some of the other things that have going on that they're very leery of the bad publicity this will likely generate. But the question is, legally, I think the NFLPA is in the right here in that if, he was suspended for the child abuse charges, those charges have been resolved. He's going to, in the eyes of the state, so to speak, he's going to do his time. So why can't he play football now? Well, the NFL is like, I don't know about this. And the Vikings want the guy back. So if they don't reinstate him, the NFLPA is going to then file what's called an expedited non-injury grievance, and that would force them to probably reinstate him immediately. So this is one of those things where if the NFL hadn't screwed up earlier, they would have more of a timeline or a way to handle this more appropriately to now. Instead of now with this, because they have that new personal conduct policy, I think this might be the first test of that. This is one of those things where I thought, Peterson should have got more punishment. I would never hit a kid, period, let alone with a stick. But this is one of those things where if he is legally eligible to play, well, I think you got to let him play. I mean, if you let Mike Vick play, why can't you let Adrian Peterson play? If you let Ray Rice back in the league, and that's coming to a head too, because now he wants to be reinstated as well. So that's one of those things where Rice will say, well, you put Peterson back in, how come I can't come back in? So it's going to get really messy for the NFL, Greg.
One of the most important words in the legal world is precedent, because once precedent is set, it is very difficult to then go against that precedent. And you're absolutely right about Vic is a good example. This is still the United States of America, where if you serve your punishment or if you fulfill your obligations, you've done that, and now it's time to, this is still what the U.S. of A., which says that, if you do your time, if you will. And,
we're a country of second chances.
Of course. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, my goodness, I would hate to live in a country we were all judged by our first offense, and that was it. I mean, my gosh. Now, granted, I mean, there's some first offenses that are off the charts. I'm saying, we're not talking about murder here. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be well received. Of course not. But, you know, hey, you know, I would just ask those folks to look at themselves and say, you know, have you ever done anything where you were given a second chance, or you were very remorseful, and or you learned a lesson, or you were more cognizant of your behavior. Everybody's mm-hmm. got one of those stories to tell, and it may not always be involving their job and losing their job, or temporarily losing their job. But you know, I mean, come on now. I mean, we also can't be everybody's judge and jury. I mean, I'm like you. I would never hit, and I never did hit our child, and I never would. And I certainly wouldn't do it the way that he did. But that doesn't mean that he's, you know, you can't, I mean, it doesn't mean he's a bad person. It means he's got a different way of discipline. You know, I don't believe that now is a broad stroke brush to cast him as a, now he may be less, you know, he's probably less of a person in a lot of other people's eyes, but you know what? It's a tough one. You're right. It's a tough one for the NFL because to be fair to the NFL, at what point do they say, look, we can't be everybody's, you know, nanny here. Mm-hmm. We can't, you know, we would love it if our players were exemplary citizens 100% of the time in 100% of the circumstances, but that's not the way life is either. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, that's just not the way it is. I mean, it would be great if everybody in the league was this. Everybody would be just so super duper. But that's just not. And a lot of these things, Al, are not necessarily law breaking per se, but they're just not very well received in the social arena. But at what point does the NFL say, look, you know, we can't legislate the behavior of every single athlete in our league under every single circumstance, ranging from child rearing. Now we're going to get involved in child rearing. To, I mean, it's one thing to smoke a joint or do something drunk driving or something, and now we're going to be, you know, legislating the way our players, you know, discipline their children. I mean, at what point do you draw a line and say, you know, we're not just going to get involved in that anymore? I mean, you know, we would love it. We don't want to. We don't. Maybe not a spot. We, you know, the league can't, you know, then I don't know. It's just, you're right. It's a tough one because everything is public perception and you know, you got the thug mentality, but sometimes I don't know that it's thug mentality. It's just a different way of doing things that, you know, that you can't tell me there aren't a lot of fans that are of the NFL who don't, you can't tell me that there aren't fans in the NFL who don't beat their children. You know, so I don't know what I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of fans of the NFL.
Well, there's a lot who thought he was in the right, in other words. They really did.
Yeah, he had some players come to his defense and say, well, yeah, I'm not going to let anybody tell me how to discipline my child.
Exactly.
Okay, fine. I get it. You know, it's not my preferred method, but, you know, I mean, the only thing is, you know, they always say that child abuse begets more child abuse. It's a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, that Peterson may be unwittingly creating a scenario where that child, when he grows up, will when he has children, will do the same thing. And I don't know, but maybe not. We don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
It may go the other way. He may say, the kid may say, you know what? I got beaten when I was a kid and I didn't like it, so I'm not going to do it with my kid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we're both in agreement, though. If Peterson's legally eligible to play and the Vikings want him back, well, I don't see the NFL really can't stop him at this point.
Right.
Because you know, at that point, it could get really ugly legally, and I don't think the NFL wants to get any more ugly legal struggles at this point, or they want to save all their effort against Ray Rice. We'll find out about that probably next few weeks as well. All right, why don't you give me question two of the birthday game, Greg?
Okay, this person was born in 1955. He made his name in baseball. He started with the San Francisco Giants, I would tell you, where he played his first 10 years of his career. And he ended up being a star with the Giants, transferred that stardom to the Cardinals as a four-time All-Star, two-time Silver Slugger, and was known as one of the most feared right-hand hitters in the National League before he ended up with the Padres and the Red Sox.
Yeah, this is one of those where I completely forgot he was a Giant, even though he, I believe he spent the majority of his career with them. But he was a vital part of the Cardinals' mini-dynasty in the mid-'80s. I think we're talking about Jack Clark, correct?
We're talking about Jack Clark. Very good. Yes, Jack Clark, who had that awkward way in the batter's box. He would move his feet just before he would swing. It was one of the weirdest things I ever saw. The very unconventional mm-hmm. swing, this footwork he would do in the batter's box. So Jack Clark is the correct answer. 340 home runs, 1,180 RBIs, .267 batting average. Played for the Yankees in 1988. I don't remember him with the Yankees in 88 at all.
It's one of those, maybe he was, but yeah, I don't really remember it that well either. You're right.
Yeah,
I remember him as a Cardinal, and then when you brought it up, oh yeah, he was a Giant. And after that, I think that was about all I really remember of Jack Clark.
Yeah, that was Clark was part of that young outfielder with Terry Whitfield and Larry Herndon, and those guys, they all kind of came up together. So he is the correct answer, and so a year's supply of Bazooka gum is on its way.
Oh, wonderful. All right, let's move on to college football. And that, well, the Big Ten, it looks like they're going to miss out on a big payday at this point. Because thanks to Michigan State getting absolutely clubbed into submission by Ohio State on Saturday night, it looks like the Big Ten is not going to put a team into the Final Four of the college football playoff. Because this is how it breaks down. The only rankings that really matter, yes, there's the AP and the coaches poll and all that crap. The only one that really matters at this point is the college football playoff rankings poll. And coming into the weekend, Michigan State was ranked number 8. And it was really falling into place because earlier on Saturday, some higher ranked teams lost or were looking like they were in trouble. And Michigan State was really Michigan State's one loss was a, if there could be a good loss, Michigan State's loss to Oregon was a good loss. And that was on the road. They played well for three quarters, you know, they're mitigating circumstances, so to speak. But the Big Ten's next highest rated team was Ohio State at 14, pretty much out of it. Even though I think Ohio State was playing better than anybody in the Big Ten. And they showed it Saturday night because they absolutely pummeled Michigan State 49-37, and Michigan State gave up almost 600 yards worth of offense. So, but the problem is with this, Greg, is Ohio State had one of the worst losses of the season of a team expected to be in contention. They lost 35-21 in the first game of the year to Virginia Tech, who are now only 4-5. So that's considered a bad loss. You know, it's goofy that we have to talk about good losses and bad losses, but that's how college football works nowadays.
Right.
So when you combine that Virginia Tech loss with the Big Ten's awful reputation, and you just had to watch Michigan Northwestern. If you watch that game, you're like, the Big Ten sucks because that was one of the worst games you could ever see.
Yeah.
And so when you factor in the Big Ten's reputation and that ugly loss, despite Ohio State, many are saying, is playing as well as any team in the country now, they really don't have much of a chance at the title shot. So right now, the four teams that would make at the season end of the day, you know, I guess they'll have a new poll on Tuesday. Right now, it's Mississippi State, Florida State, Oregon, and Alabama. Oregon and Alabama each have one loss. Mississippi State and Florida State are undefeated. But this is one of those things where right now, the Big Ten's reputation, and we've talked about it a few times in the podcast this year, it's really doing Ohio State a disservice. Because, you know, back, I guess you want to call it the old days, pre-playoff, that loss to Virginia Tech would often be ignored because they're playing so well. You know, it was always back then, it was, if you're going to lose early because they remember more. They're more likely to remember losses later in the year. Well, it's not like that anymore. If this if this power ranking stuff and strength of schedule and conference power and all, I don't know. It's just that, you know, we all wanted a college football playoff. A problem is, I guess it's just not big enough because there's more than four teams that are going to deserve to be in it. And I think Ohio State's going to be one of them, and they're not going to be able to play.
The problem I've always seen with college football playoffs is because the nature of the game is such that it's not like an NCAA basketball tournament where you can just, these teams can run off arch and play a bunch of games in a few short weeks, and you have it, you crown a champion fair and square. In football, it's the nature of the game. It's more physical. You obviously you can't play two games in 3 nights like you do in college basketball. You have to have the week off in between games. Then it becomes a case of how many playoff games are you gonna have? How many more weeks are you gonna add on to the season? On high school football, Al, they play nine weeks of regular season games, and then they add, you know, if you go all the way, you're playing another, I think, four or five games. I mean, but again, it's spread over 4 or 5 weeks because it's, you know, you play a game a week.
Right.
And so college football, my concern was always, okay, how many layers of teams do you want to have in this thing, which is going to determine how many more games these teams are going to play. They're already playing 12, sometimes 13. So what are you going to do about that? How many teams are you going to allow in? Who are they going to be? But, you know, so that was always and the other thing, of course, was you're never going to come up with a system that's going to please everybody anyway. I mean, there's always going to be folks that are going to pick it apart.
Yeah, when it's an 8-team playoff, team number 9 is going to be pissed. If it's a 16-team playoff, team number 17 is going to be pissed. It's just how it is. You're right.
Exactly. But I mean, in terms of how they go about. Now, the one thing that the bizarre – it was just almost surreal at the Michigan State game. They were showing the end of the Auburn game against Texas A&M. And Kirk Herbstreit said, when was the last time anybody in East Lansing gave a flying you-know-what about Texas A&M against Auburn?
Yeah, you're
well,
right.
Because of the playoff. And then, you know, which in that case, it's good. I mean, it gets people, fans around the country into other teams around the country. So now you've got the scenario of Michigan State fans cheering that Auburn lost, which they normally wouldn't care about, but because Auburn is in the mix, or was in the mix, and so was Michigan State at the time that they were cheering, then that became it's like anything else. You're hoping for other teams to lose, and you know, so that, you know, from that standpoint, it's good, I think, to get people, you know, kind of aware of other teams and kind of into it that way, you're right about the four teams, and I think everybody kind of knew that was, you know, that there's always going to be more than four teams, usually, that should be in the discussion. So I still think, Al, even with this playoff, you're still going to have a quote-unquote, I wouldn't say a mythical champion, but you're still going to have a champion that's going to, it's still not going to be, you know, at least with basketball, you can't deny. Right. Champion. I mean, they've won a 65-team tournament fair and square. Mm-hmm. But with the football thing, I think there's still going to be that faction of people that say, well, this and that, and they didn't do this, and they didn't do that, and these two teams didn't play, and what if they had done this? And like you said, the nature of when you lose games, unlike basketball, where it doesn't matter, if you get in the tournament, it's a whole new season.
Right.
But in football, it's, you know, to determine who gets into that thing, that's the key right there. At least with the basketball tournament, you're letting 64 teams in. It's, you know, there's really not a lot of, you know, you're always going to get teams that are going to get slighted when they have the selection Sunday. But, you know, you're still letting 64 teams in. That's still a lot of teams. And football, you know, and you got to be cognizant of how many more games you want these kids to play. That's the other thing.
Right.
I mean, at what point do you say, you know, okay, no, it's about money, but, you know, we're going to get into a situation where we're going to be playing 17, 18 games now? I mean, that's a lot for these kids to play. And I know that the athletic directors and the school presidents and fans would love it, but, you know, you got to be cognizant of that, too. How many more games do you want these teams to play beyond their regular season schedule?
Well, the one argument to that is, and how come they allow it at every other level of college football except the top level? Because the lower levels do have playoff systems in play.
True. Good point.
And that's the other argument, you know. But, you know, there's but no one really cares so much about those. And obviously the bowls are not entrenched at the lower levels. And I think more than anything, that's the difference, is that you got these damn bowl games, most of which don't mean a thing and most people don't care about and nobody goes to but they're televised and they're there for TV only. And it's even going to be weirder seeing New Year's Day, because the New Year's Day will be the Rose Bowl and the Sugar Bowl are essentially the semifinals of the national championship game. So that's right. We're watching football change, Greg. It's just going at a glacier's pace. I mean, people have been yelling for playoffs at the top level for decades, and now we're finally getting it. And we're going to see a lot of, I think, for the next few years, trying to get the semantics of it down and figuring out what's the best way about getting a national champion. And so we're seeing stuff like in the first year of it, we're going to have stuff like this, unfortunately. That's just how it is. All right. Let's move on, Greg. And you wanted to talk. I forgot to put this in the show notes, but it should have been. We need to talk about Alan Trammell rejoining the Tigers organization. So I'll let you hit the floor.
Well, I mean, Tram is coming back as a special advisor to President and GM Dave Dombrowski. He's going to be doing a number of things. He's going to be involved in scouting. He's going to be involved in evaluating players at the lower level minor leagues. He's going to be in uniform. Brad Austin says a lot during spring training. He's going to be instructing. They're even going to have him doing some community relations type activities.
Sounds like the same roles that Al Kaline and Willie Horton had for years.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And. But Kaline and Horton aren't really doing a lot of in terms of personnel
right.
They're a little bit more
community relations, as you put it.
Trammell's going to do a lot of. They say he's going to be in on personnel decisions. Not when I say in on personnel decisions, like he'll be in the room when they talk about, you know, maybe potential free agents to sign.
Part of the brain trust, in other words.
Right. Yeah. Trades to be made. I'm sure as the July 31st deadline coming, he'll be part of that. You know, and it's one of his first duties after this was announced was to go down and watch the Arizona Fall League play and watch Stephen Moya and Tyler Collins and guys like that with Brad Ausmus, who he has a relationship with, of course. And, you know, so you know, it's good to see Tram back in the organization. And, of course, this was all possible because, you know, he, along with Kirk Gibson and the whole staff at Arizona got canned mm-hmm. by Tony La Russa, so he became kind of a free agent, so to speak. And you know, Tram's been a bench coach for a long time now. He was a manager for 3 years. He's been a first base coach, a hitting coach. He's done a lot in baseball after his playing career. So this is kind of like a bullseye, I guess, in a way, a natural progression for him. This is his first time where he's done this kind of a role for any organization. It makes sense to do it with the Tigers. You know, Hats off to Dave Dombrowski for bringing him back, you know, and just goes
yeah,
to show.
Yeah, it's kind of an olive branch in a way, after the debacle that happened in the mid part of last decade.
Well, you know, Tram was, you know, after he was let go as manager of the Tigers, he was offered a very similar position to what he has now, but mm-hmm. he decided not to take it. I don't think it was out of any animosity. I think at that time, of course, he was that much younger. I don't think he was ready to do that.
He wanted to manage, yeah.
Right, so he sat out a year, then he became the bench coach for the Cubs. Mm-hmm. And so he was the bench coach for the Cubs for 4 years. Then he moved over to Arizona. So he, you know, did that. And I think that was a good move for him not to take that position the Tigers offered back then. But now he's that much older. And he's kind of been there, done that. He's done a lot, like I said, in the game. So he gets a chance now to still be in uniform during spring training, gets a chance to kind of do some stuff that he never really had a chance to do before with the Cubs and the D-backs in terms of, you know, being a presence, being part of a brain trust, like you said, contributing what he knows, especially in the National League. And that's the other thing, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Tram has spent a lot of his time in the National League since he left the Tigers. He was with, like I said, with the Cubs in the since 2007. He's been with the Cubs or the D-backs mm-hmm. since 2007. So he's seen a lot of National League baseball, and a lot more than I'm sure the Tigers brain trust has seen. When it comes time to, you know, making, you know, should we sign this guy or trade for this guy, you know, it's nice to have that guy in that room who's seen a lot of these National League players play. Now, I know there's interleague play, but that's nothing compared to seeing these guys over and over and over again like Trammell has seen mm-hmm. in the last 7 years being in the National League. And, you know, there's still, even with interleague play, Al, there's still a delineation between National League players and American League players, and it never hurts to have a guy in the room who has seen these guys play, these players play, you know, multiple times, like Trammell has seen. And not only that, but he's been around a lot of these guys, either in opposing dugouts or in the same dugout. So that's never a bad thing. So I think it's a win-win situation for everybody involved. I don't see this, Al, as a strictly titular thing where he just has a title and it's going to have a do-nothing job. He's going to actually earn his money. You know, he's going to actually be involved. He's going to do a lot of things. And, you know, it's going to flush itself out as it goes on. But already, he's, you know, like I say, he's Arizona Fall League already. You know, I'm sure he'll be doing some stuff. Osmus says he'll be doing a lot of instructing in spring training. He'll be in uniform a lot. So it'll be good. It'll be good.
I would just add that hopefully this may be a first step towards getting his number retired. Now that he's back with the organization, everything seems to be, you know, back as it should be. You know, I don't think anybody really felt Trammell was ready to be a manager when the Tigers made him a manager. And in a way, he was a sacrificial lamb for the organization, you know, trying to, he did his part for the organization that he stepped in probably when he wasn't ready. Right. And the team used him and his cohorts, what Gibson was on the staff, Lance Harris was on the staff. Yeah. That, they would, they use them instead of the players as promotion.
Sure.
So, you know, maybe, you know, I'm glad to see him back. And realistically, his and Whitaker's numbers should have been retired a long time ago. Hopefully this will be our first step in maybe getting that last bridge crossed. But hey, I have no problem with bringing Alan Trammell back to the organization. You make a great point in that, especially now that he's spent the last decade working in the National League. That can only help the Tigers when it comes to, as you said, player analysis and team analysis. So this is a good thing for everybody involved. It really is. All right, Greg, let's wrap up the show. So who is your jerk of the week?
This is a very simple, easy one. It's not going to take a lot of time. It's the referee for the Michigan State, Ohio State game, who in one of his penalty calls said that the penalty was on Michigan. I don't know if you caught that or not. There was a penalty where he said holding Michigan, and boy, did that draw the howls and hoots from that crowd at East Lansing. You don't make a mistake like that. So my trick of the week, I don't even know what the guy's name is, the referee who called out Michigan instead of Michigan State. I'm not sure if he was just trying to, you know, abbreviate it or what, but you don't do that. Don't do that. Bad job. So jerk of the week is the referee for Michigan State, Ohio State.
All right. My jerk of the week, I'm going back to NASCAR because we kind of missed on this last week because there was another fight, another ridiculous fight. And it's essentially, you know, over what happened on the track. You know, no one was hurt. And in the big scheme of things, it really would, you know, the fight didn't mean much. And neither what happened on the track at the time, you know, it involved Michigan's own Brad Keselowski, as it usually seems to do, that he pisses people off and they attack him after the race. But this one, I'm putting this on NASCAR because NASCAR has brought this upon themselves with this stupid playoff system they have, where essentially they started with 16 drivers who quote unquote made the playoffs, or they call it, you know, and then they would eliminate four drivers after every few races. So it gets to the point where if you fall so far behind in the points, you have to win a race. So that to move on in these quote unquote playoffs. So that means you're going to have drivers taking risks that they may not normally take because they know they need to win a race to move forward. And that's one of the reasons why Keselowski got himself in trouble with a couple of drivers, because he needed to take a huge risk to try and win a race. And this is one of those things where NASCAR, I think, secretly loves it because it draws attention to the sport, even though this is the time of year where most people who, you know, especially casual fans of racing are more likely watching every other, you know, football, college football, and NFL football. I mean, I would call myself a very casual fan of stock car racing, and I haven't watched a race in a few months since football season started, because football is much more compelling to me. But regardless of all that, my jerk of the week is NASCAR for one, not suspending anybody again for a post-race brouhaha, and two, for coming up with this asinine playoff system that forces drivers to take risks that could hurt themselves and others because it's either win or go home. And it doesn't reward consistency. This new form of rewards winning. But when you do that, you're also asking for trouble when you have guys knowing that it's win, or you'll have pissed off sponsors for getting knocked out of the playoffs. So my jerk of the week once again is NASCAR. I could probably make it weekly at this point.
Well, you know what? Yeah. Well, you know what? I tell you what, though. I mean, you make a good point about you know, needlessly putting, or you know, putting drivers at risk or forcing them to take risks. And I'm starting to see, you know, one of the things I always liked about NASCAR is, or respected about NASCAR, I should say, was that they knew their place. They knew what kind of that they were a niche sport, and that they were okay with that, and they didn't try to, you know, market to anybody other than the people that they knew were, you know, would be into it. And now I'm starting to see a little bit of signs of stuff that's a little untoward, and maybe they're not content with that anymore. They're trying to push the envelope a little bit. So that's a good call there. I want to let everybody know you can follow me on Twitter at Greg Eno. Follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter at the Knee Jerks. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, and our blog, TheKneeJerks.us. Read me at GregEno.com. Read me at BlessYouBoys.com. By the way, at BlessYouBoys.com, starting today, Monday, I'll be taking a trip back in time through this off season, and I'll be looking back at some of the Tigers free agent signings of the past throughout the Hot Stove League. I thought that might be kind of fun. Now, first up is Darrell Evans, so look out for that. Expect another one of those every couple of weeks on BlessYouBoys.com. Blog.DetroitAthletic.com. You can read me as well. And I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon, and thank you, Big Al, for making Monday Night So Gosh Show.
Indeed, Greg. I really appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule to talk sports with me every week. As always, you can find me on Twitter, Big Al BYB. Also be on the lookout for the Bless You Boys podcast. We're probably going every 3 weeks or so in the off season. So be on the lookout for another podcast from Hook 5 and myself probably towards the end of November. And other than that, of course, be on the lookout for the Knee Jerks podcast, which we're doing every week. We're on a roll right now, Greg. I can't remember the last time we missed one. So after seemingly like missing every other week during the summer. So
right.
All right, but with that, of course, follow us at the usual places. You can get both those podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, the usual podcast deep places. All right, let's wrap it up. So until this time next week, we're hopefully we'll have. Another Lions victory to talk about. This is Al Beaton saying good evening and good luck and aloha.
Shalom, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.